This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And are you ready to put your predictions to the test? Well, with Interactive Brokers Forecast Trader, you can trade your views on key political, economic, and climate indicators. Simply answer yes or no. For example, will the year-over-year change in the U.S. Consumer Price Index exceed 2.4% in March of 2025? Well, that's one thing. How about, will the average U.S. temperature in 2024 be greater than 54 degrees? If you agree, buy a yes contract. If you don't, well, buy a no contract. It's that easy. Contracts cost 2 to 99 cents, and correct predictions earn $1 at settlement. And incorrect ones settle at zero. Forecast contracts are commission-free. Plus, they earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon, and new accounts get $3 to trade forecast contracts. Visit ibkr.com/forecast and make your predictions today. The best-informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Member SIPC.
The disciplined investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Ouch! I mean, ouch! Rates on the rise, whacking stocks. The employment report for December, surprisingly strong. And some insights on the recent market action. Our guest today is Pat Kamusu. He is an expert on cryptocurrency taxation. All this and much more on episode number 903 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey there, Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to another great edition, a great episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So happy to be here, even though it is freezing down here in South Florida. Well, not freezing, but in the 50s and 60s. Listen, my heart, my thoughts, everything is going out to you over in California, in the areas that have been ravaged by those flames. I'm so sorry, and hopefully you'll get yourself out of harm's way. And for those of you that have had the destruction and the absolute just chaos that broke out with all those fires, there's nothing I could say to help, but you know, my heart is with you for all that's going on right now. And as everybody that is listening, let's talk about markets for a second. Volatility clearly spiking up. The VIX getting towards 20 again after moving down to about 15 earlier in the week, as we are seeing some things happening in the markets that are causing a lot of concern. It's not only the crazy stuff going on in the Washington Central area, you know what I mean by that, but it's also what's happening with regard to the potential for what is going to go on with the outlook for inflation. Right now, it looks like no rate cuts until maybe, well, June, if that. And that's because of things that are going on with regard to the price indices inside of the recent ISM services and what we saw, of course, on Friday with regard to the employment situation. So pretty interesting things that are going on. Some things I want to talk about before we get to our guest today. I want to talk about some of the things. Well, we have the inauguration coming up, right? That's going to be in about, 10 days from now or so, or 7-8 days from now, from when this was launched on Sunday, the 12th of January. And some interesting history about that. You may have listened to it on DH Unplugged, but if you haven't listened, first of all, you have to subscribe. You have to go and listen to DH Unplugged. Myself and John C. Dvorak talking about some great stuff each and every Tuesday. That show comes out, and I got to tell you something. That show, we really cover an incredible amount of depth when it comes to markets, financial news, and set the record straight as to what's really going on. But some of the things we talked about, one of the things I thought was interesting, a tidbit of trivia. We talked about what was the shortest and what was the longest inaugural address in history. And the shortest goes back to George Washington. It was his second inaugural address, actually. It was delivered in 1793. It was only 135 words. I mean, it could have been, hey, thanks a lot for the vote of confidence. I'll do my best. See you again in 4 years, maybe, or something. I don't know. But it was 135 words long. Now, the longest, which I thought was interesting, William Henry Harrison, back in 1841, his inaugural address was the longest, with a totality of 8,455 words. That was a cold day. It was freezing out there. The weather was terrible. It was windy. It was bad weather. It was wet. It was humid. He was out there doing his thing, giving his speech. And you know what happened then? If you didn't know what was called the rest of the story, he died a month later after his inaugural address from pneumonia, which they do bring back to the probability of being caused by exposure to bad weather on Inauguration Day. A little bit of interesting thoughts there. I don't know. This is the second inaugural address by Trump. You know, he likes to talk. So it's probably going to be somewhere in the middle of the two, clearly. I don't think the shortest nor the longest. But that's going to be in about 8 days from now. And in terms of the markets, here, we're back in action. It's back in January. A little bit of insights on what I think is going on these moves. And of course, a lot of it is predicated on what is happening with interest rates. We went from about 3.6% on the 10-year. That was back when the Fed started first reducing rates. Everybody was all giddy, thinking that rates were going to go down. And I've been talking about, if you've been sticking around listening here for a while to anything I've been talking about on this show or on DH Unplugged, the comments I've been making in public as well, the thoughts, the updates we've been giving to clients was that interest rates were actually going to be going higher. The fact that the Fed was not done with inflation and they felt compelled to reduce rates, and then you add on to that what happened in November, the election of Trump, who's, you know, tariff happy and, you know, looking for economic growth, and the fact that we did not see any significant let up in economic growth or a significant slowdown overall in the employment situation led me to believe that the Fed was dead wrong. You know about that. We're not going to get into that discussion anymore today, but the fact remains that we clipped 4.7%. on the 10-year on Friday after that jobs report. That was after a big move up, which the resistance points was about 4.6. And yes, these are key levels when it comes to bonds, that 4.6 would lead to about a 4.7 and change. If you breached and moved above that resistance point on a 4.7, you were on your way to 5%. That's what it's looking like right now. Now, as expected, the start of the year is typically a time when, you know, people make resolutions that most of us hope to keep. I think personally, and I've talked about this for years, resolutions, a thing of the past, something we don't really want to bring up because resolutions are, as I see it, something that's meant to be broken or at least not adhered to. A commitment, a written down commitment and a promise is something different than a simple, well, a resolution. A resolution is not final. It's not voted in. It is not completed. It is not put down in paper, in pen, not in pencil. It is not engraved and entombed. It is not put in concrete. A resolution is flimsy. In the finance world, we hear oftentimes about returning to discipline, cutting losers, adding to winners, and adhering to all these fundamental rules. Additionally, at this time of year, investors may be considering becoming more aggressive, or maybe even less aggressive, more diversified, or investing in last year's winners. Now, what happens is these thoughts and actions, as I see it, contribute to market volatility. Very simple. And that usually fades away within a couple of months when resolutions are forgotten. You know what I'm talking about. I've talked about this before. You heard me talk about it, like the parking lots at local gyms. You know, they're packed every January, right? Everybody's like, I'm going to work out. I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to get on it again. I'm going to get healthy. That's January. That's when we make those resolutions. But what happens? Plenty of spots are opened up in March when people just simply say, ugh, I'm going to go back to my old ways. It's much easier. Cheeseburgers in paradise, French fries. Forget about this natural food stuff. Forget about being gluten-free. Forget about being off the booze, etc. So getting back to, you know, what's going on? What's happening in the markets right now? I think that, as we've been talking about, that the economy is relatively strong. The Fed, especially that last move, that last rate cut of 25 basis points, totally unnecessary. Let's just get that out there. Totally unnecessary. But what we saw was a resurgence in the ISM services index. That was number one. That was earlier in the week that made that last move from below 4.6 to above 4.6. We increased to 54.1% in December. Now, what's important here is expectations were for about a 53% move, you know, to about 53 from 52.1, which was November. And we have to remember the dividing line from contraction to expansion is 50. ISM manufacturing still is in contraction, has been for a while. Services doing pretty well for a long time, but this acceleration from November was really important to note. Now, the report, when you look at what's going on, and this was from briefing.com, their report that I gleaned this information from, was that this was a double whammy. This was a problem when it came to rate cut expectations. The expansion in services sector activity accelerated. That's number one. The second problem was that prices inside of there, the index of prices, picked up dramatically. It was printing its first reading above 60 since January 2024. That's a year later when we thought, hey, inflation was down. So the business activity production index increased to 58 from 53 inside the services index, which about 70% of our economy is based on services, only 30% on manufacturing. So the importance of this report can't be underscored enough. Now, the new orders index moved up to 54 and a little over 54 from 53.7. The employment index dipped a little bit, but basically just a 0.1%. But again, this price index moved to 64.4 from 58.2. The supplier delivery index moved to 52.5 from 49. And the backlog of orders index fell a little bit. That was the one thing that you'd say, okay, well, you know, at least we see that it's not coming in hard and fast continually with regard to the backlog of orders. In other words, they're getting orders out. Not a lot of orders are coming in. That's what I'm hearing from everybody in the manufacturing business as well. So something to consider. Now, one more thing. I want to talk about something that's going on. Let me grab this because I want to read this to you. This is for all of you that have 401k plans. There has been a change this year. It's a strange one. This is a part of the Secure 2.0 legislation that passed at the end of 2022. Specifically, it's Section 109 of the Secure 2.0 Act. And it's these new rules regarding catch-up contributions for 401k plans. So this is specifically targeted to people who are over the age of 50 who could defer an additional $7,500 for a total of $30,500 in your employee contributions to your 401k plan. But that's okay. That's up a little bit from where it was. And if you're not doing that, I'm going to say shame on you. I'm shaking a little finger here. Shame on you. You need to be piling as much as you can into your 401k plan, whether it's your 401k on the tax free side or the tax, not tax free, but the tax deductible side or the Roth, which is non-tax deductible, but get tax free on the back end. Here's the deal that I want you to listen to. If you are the age of 60 to 63 in the year 2025, Section 109 extends the catch-up amount for those in that age range. I don't know how they picked that up, but you could add another, I think it's $3,500. So instead of the catch-up being $7,500, it's going to $11,250. Instead of $31,000 in total that you could put away, it's $34,750. If you're age 40, 64 or older, it's $31,000. I don't know, maybe someone who is that age for whatever reason and is going to retire that was in Congress put this into play. I don't know. Don't ask what this weirdness is about why those are the numbers, but those are the numbers. So make sure that you are putting in as much as you can. It's probably not going to be automatic. You probably need to change your numbers. Contact your 401k administrator. Contact your employer, somebody, and say, hey, I want to increase my tax. They're going to be, what are you talking about? Well, tell them that Andrew said that as part of Secure 2.0 in Section 109, the catch-up provisions for me, age 60 to 63, are increased, and I can put a total of $34,750 per year away. So please increase that for me this year. There you go. Let's get to our guest. And our guest today is Pat Camuso. He's the CPA and founder of Camuso CPA, which is an industry-leading firm working closely with cryptocurrency investors and Web3 businesses that was among the first CPA firms to specialize in crypto taxes back in 2016. So basically a pioneer in the field. Pat's been on before. And of course, what's interesting is he even believed in it so much that he started receiving and accepting cryptocurrency as payments for his services. So he's a host of the Financial Frontier podcast, which in that podcast, they explore the trends in crypto, tax, and finance. He also runs the Digital Asset Digest, a newsletter delivering insights into blockchain, digital assets, and tax compliance. So he's author of the Navigating the Net Sales Tax Maze, a Wayfair 2.0 and Web 3.0 and central resource for navigating sales tax in the digital asset space. So the bottom line of all this, Pat, is you're a damn expert in this area, aren't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've been at the crypto tax thing for a while now.
Wow. Well, it's interesting because, you know, and I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but in the beginning, people were like, we're not going to worry about the taxes.
Oh, yeah. When, you know, during, I would say the time frame, especially between, you know, 2016 to 2018 or even 19, no one was worried about the taxes. Yeah. And, you know, the industry has matured since those early days. But I would say, like, overall, to a degree, that sentiment still remains. And even today, you know, you can go on the IRS's website and they will cite that there is a 75% non-compliance rate amongst taxpayers related to their crypto transactions, meaning only they're claiming only 25% of people are claiming their cryptocurrency transactions accurately on their returns. And they say that's based off of data that they've collected from exchanges and through other methods that they have. So even to this day, there's, you know, a high degree of non-compliance, but we've definitely seen some maturity and, you know, more people moving towards compliance for sure.
It's kind of like the early days of tipping when you didn't have to declare your tips because it was under the table. A lot of the digital assets and cold wallets and things like that, I'm sure, are in that. But let's go back. How did you initially get involved in the intersection of crypto and taxes?
Sure. Well, you know, I always wanted to be a CPA and own my own CPA firm. So I, you know, I went to school for accounting and finance.
I mean, wait. When you were a kid, like 8 years old?
Like, I would say maybe like 15 or 16.
Really?
Or so,
you know, did you have somebody that you looked at that you saw that this was going on? It looked like a great life?
No, actually I didn't. But what I knew is that, you know, I needed to understand the fundamentals of business, of finance and money if I was going to create a life of financial freedom for myself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I took the approach of starting from the ground floor and building those that skill set as an accountant. And building the finance degree just so I could start to make myself more valuable to investors and to businesses and, you know, start to build a career and, you know, build my net worth at that early age. And with the hopes that opportunities like crypto and these types of things would reveal themselves to me, which they did. So back then, yeah, I was just, you know, a young kid that wanted to build a financial future for myself. And I just saw accounting as a great way for someone that, you know, doesn't have a family with like a deep business background or anything like that to break into the field. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I started pursuing that accounting degree. I started working at Deloitte first as an intern and then as an associate there. I worked there for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. So that's where I started my career, was at Deloitte. When I was there, I worked in their financial services group. So we were doing the accounting and taxes for hedge fund companies, mutual fund companies.
People like me.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, back then we were, you know, the types of clients were like BlackRock, Apollo, Bank of New York, Mellon, like those types of clients. Yeah. And when we were working with them, we were helping transition their accounting systems. And we were dealing with very large data sets of unformatted transactions that we had to apply tax adjustments to. So I built up a good experience there of working with these funds and, you know, dealing with thousands, sometimes millions of their transactions from a tax and accounting perspective. So I built up good experience there. And, you know, I kept self-educating as well, learning about the financial system, about precious metals and all these types of things. So while I was at Deloitte, I was, you know, on some gold forum late at night, and I came across the Bitcoin white paper and, you know, immediately recognized the value in it. Then, you know, I did like everyone else, told all my friends and family about it, and basically, you know, got some myself and just kept working. And then towards the end of 2016, people started asking me about the tax implications, and it kind of just prompted me to realize that crypto taxes are going to be a huge thing in the future. So, you know, I took a chance in 2016 and launched my firm. Then it was still pretty small in terms of like the industry and stuff, and, you know, really just working with Bitcoin miners and investors. And then my firm's just grown with the proliferation of the industry. You know, started with Bitcoin investors and miners, then it went to people getting in Ethereum, and then we saw all these ICOs, then the proliferation of blockchains, then we've seen, you know, DeFi, NFTs, Web3. So we've just been growing and learning with all these iterations, and it's placed me and my firm in a great position because, you know, now a lot of professionals are trying to, you know, address this learning curve because there's tons of clients to serve, and clients are bringing them issues as well. And, you know, they're looking at a decade long learning curve at this point. You won't pick up on all this.
So what are some of the misconceptions that people have? Maybe that not the ones that are not the non-compliant ones that are non-compliant because they're non-compliant. You know what I'm saying? I mean, the misconceptions about when we deal with any of this crypto and the tax laws.
Well, you know, most people just think like, first of all, most people when they come to our firm haven't done their crypto accounting for years. So, you know, they kind of think like it's just a really simple thing that they can get done just by plugging their wallets or exchanges into a software. They'll get some tax result and that there shouldn't be any surprises. But what I find is, especially if people have been transacting for several years, there's going to be taxable events that they were maybe unaware of, especially if they were trading, you know, certain larger cap cryptos like an Ethereum or Solana into other assets, into other altcoins, into other NFTs. A lot of times there's, you know, hidden taxable events there because a crypto is taxable anytime you dispose of it.
I thought if I bought crypto A and I sold crypto A for, let's say, a gain, and I bought crypto B, that should be a taxable event, it would seem to me. Am I making it too simplistic?
No, you're right. So anytime you dispose of a crypto, whether you dispose of it for cash, for services, or to buy another crypto, they're all taxable events. But what I find is a lot of times people will be doing these exchanges with Ethereum into another coin, and they're just not realizing the taxable events that they get hit with within it, especially if it's over several years. And partly it's because they're maybe not aware that of the taxability of those dispositions. Another part of it is, you know, there's much more complexity to this than a lot of people expect. And one factor that is a big consideration is the accounting method that you select. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if people haven't taking the appropriate steps up to this point, they're likely going to have to use FIFO, which is first in, first out, which can lead to sometimes unexpected tax consequences because it's going to be your earliest purchases that get taxed first.
So you got FIFO, which is first in, first out. We got LIFO, which is last in, first out. Could we use average cost-based accounting for crypto?
Well, you know, the accounting method decision is very interesting because there's been some big changes with crypto taxes in 2024 that have kind of clarified things that people have been doing incorrectly for years with their accounting methodology. And it's provided guidance as to, you know, the correct way to be doing things going forward in the future. So in the past, what we've seen taxpayers do a lot of times, and we've never suggested this because we were able to foresee this issue, but they'll do their crypto accounting on what's called a universal basis. And that's how most people before 2025 have been doing their accounting. It's on this universal basis, meaning if you have multiple wallets, multiple exchanges, you know, you plug them all into a software and you apply an accounting method on an asset per asset basis. So, you know,
give me an example. Go back to crypto A, crypto B, crypto C.
Well, let's do it in the sense of, like, if you have five different wallets and they all hold Ethereum.
Oh,
you will apply an accounting method just to the asset Ethereum. That's under the universal method. Under the account by account method, you have to apply the accounting method for each wallet that Ethereum is held in. So you can see how those calculations can become very different.
Well, that would be the same if I have an brokerage account with Apple in it, another yes. brokerage account with Apple in it, and another brokerage yes. account with Apple in it. Yep. I sell Apple in brokerage account A. The universal would say, let's look at the totality of all my Apple.
Yes. And then apply an accounting method, just for instance, FIFO.
Versus the right way to do it is I sold it that asset. I mean, in that yes. account.
Exactly. So, you know, before 2025, most, if not all, taxpayers were doing these calculations on a universal method. And it's because that's what most of the accounting softwares were
capable of.
Exactly. That's what they were capable of at that time. And what a lot of taxpayers would want to do is apply HIFO on this universal basis. So, you know, picture this example. Let's say, you know, you have five accounts. One of them's Coinbase, four of them are wallets. And you sell an Ethereum and you're under highest cost on a universal basis. It's going to choose the highest cost out of any of those four wallets and apply them to that sale on Coinbase. So a lot of times what we would see when people are doing these calculations is they'll be applying a cost to a sale on Coinbase, the highest cost that's in one of these other wallets, and they never even transferred that asset to Coinbase. So it's basically like a completely inaccurate audit trail. They're going
to
say,
I mean, yeah, I think if they would have transferred all of it to Coinbase at that moment before they applied it and then merged them together, you could deal with that. But the problem then is, then you don't have the ability to do really. You can still do tax lot accounting then, but still, it seems that that would be a bad idea. That was destined to fail.
It was destined to fail, and we always advised against it. And it was finally just in 2024 where the IRS released Revenue Procedure 2024-28, which basically said that the universal method is not going to be accepted anymore. And not only that, but that standing orders are required for people that are using SPEC ID. Now, technically speaking, you know, you'll see these people using HIFO and all these accounting methods, but really when it comes down to it, the default method for accounting for cryptocurrency is FIFO. The only other acceptable method is specific identification.
Specific identification is a good way in general to do tax accounting of your lots.
Yes. Now, issues people would run into, though, is number one, they try to do HIFO.
Well, of course they did. Of course they did. So they do that so they can pay the least tax.
Yeah, and it's just a complete mess from that perspective. But then the other thing, too, is if you're going to apply SPEC ID to something, to a fungible cryptocurrency, it's not like you're dealing with a security where there's a unique identifier such as a CUSIP that you can use to say, I'm selling, you know, this specific Ethereum over another one. You know, like if you have 20 Ethereum sitting in your Coinbase and you choose to sell one, there's no CUSIP or identifier that you can provide them to say, we're choosing this tax lot or this other tax lot.
Right. And then the other problem is the non-cold wallets, the regular wallets, you know, talking about Coinbase or you know, choose whichever custodian, let's call it a custodian for lack of a better thought in my mind. You know, they weren't accounting for it either. I mean, I have a Coinbase account and I got to tell you something. I've plugged in my cost basis like three times. It still doesn't seem to recognize it.
Yes, exactly. There's tons of inaccuracies with that. So not only have they required now this account-based tracking, but they've introduced the concept of standing orders. And that's a requirement going forward for anyone that's not using FIFO. So what standing orders are is an acceptable method to apply specific identification to cryptocurrencies. And what it requires is that you document standing orders in your books and records for non-custodial wallets and with your brokers for, you know, exchanges such as Coinbase that are going to say, you know, we're going to apply X, Y, or Z accounting methodology to these assets. So you can say like, we're applying LIFO to all the cryptos that we transfer here, or, you know, to X, Y, or Z crypto. And those standing orders will suffice for specifically identifying which lot is sold before the transaction. So that's what this revenue procedure did, is it's changed everyone from this universal basis to this account basis. And if you want to use anything other than FIFO, you need to set up standing orders before you dispose of these assets.
Right.
The problem for people is that this revenue procedure required certain steps for compliance to be taken before January 1st of 2025. So, you know, if people are watching this and they've been doing their calculations on a universal basis and they haven't complied with this revenue procedure, they can be facing some tax consequences from that.
Yeah. I mean, my stuff is, I've sat on it and I haven't traded it since whatever year it is. I just let it just sit there, do its thing. Do I got a problem?
Well, you know, the what I would want to look at first is how did you do your accounting in prior years?
Never.
Yeah. So if you never did your accounting,
the reason why, because I bought and hold. So what accounting do I need to do?
If you just went from USD to
that's what I'm talking about. A couple of transactions here or there, but nothing major. I mean, small. I mean,
yeah.
Usually it was just building it up.
Usually what I would suggest for someone like you, now that we're past the deadline, if you've never done your accounting, is that we do the accounting and we just start it on this account by account based accounting, because, you know, then you're in compliance with the account based requirements and you don't have to worry about the deadline to comply with this revenue procedure, because the revenue procedure is designed to take people who have calculated on a universal basis and then allocate those calculated basis to each account where the assets are being held. So for someone like you, you know, the best approach would likely be, and, you know, it gets very specific for each person, but for your fact pattern, the best approach would likely be to start from the earliest transactions and calculate everything with the correct methodology for each year. And then that way you work your way up to getting an accurate historical basis.
So if somebody bought Bitcoin and spent $50,000 in whatever year, and I'm just going to use bogus numbers here. Doesn't matter what's worth now. Doesn't matter what's worth. And didn't do anything. Just bought it. That's it. Stuck it in the account. It's in the Coinbase account. Any special things they need to do?
If they just bought Bitcoin.
One time.
So they only have one tax lot.
Yeah.
No, there's not much that needs to be done there. Yeah. I still suggest doing.
I'm glad to hear that, because otherwise that's frightening.
Yeah, I still suggest doing your accounting each year, though, so you have your whole entire cost basis calculated and supported. So, you know, if you do get some tax notice from Coinbase that you dispose of something and they don't have a cost basis for it, you're able to already have to reconcile the accounting for that.
When is it going to get to a point that the custodians, I'm not talking about you holding your own wallets, that's not what I'm talking about, but when is it going to get to be a point that they grow up and they do the tax accounting and they require it to be at this date? I mean, we've been doing that with brokerage account for years.
What's interesting is that's actually starting now in 2025. And that was part of the reason why we even seen revenue procedure 2024-28 get put out. Basically, starting this year, you will start receiving a new tax form called the 1099 DA. And DA stands for digital assets. So it's going to be similar to reporting that you get from like your traditional brokers if you're trading securities, and they're going to start reporting the proceeds and the cost basis and the calculated gains or losses related to your transactions on their platform. So that's going to start this year. They're going to report proceeds and then they're going to start reporting cost basis details in subsequent years.
That's good.
But you know, there's going to be a lot of issues with that, especially initially. Now, if you're someone that's just trading on Coinbase, you know, it can probably be pretty clean. But if you're going to be moving in and out of Coinbase between different wallets and exchanges, you know,
it's complicated.
There's the potential for discrepancies, and there's the potential that especially in 2026, you're going to have to really watch that. Their basis calculations are aligned with your calculations.
Yeah. Now, by the way, I'm a little bit older than you. When I was young, when we talked about a DA or something, you know, you talked about getting a haircut and I'm getting a DA. Do you know what that was?
No.
A DA was a duck's ass. You'd get the back of your hair feathered in to look like the back of a tail of a duck, a duck's ass.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah, I haven't heard that one. Yep. I haven't heard.
That's what it was.
Now, one thing that's really interesting with this 1099 DA is that, you know, the finalized broker regs, they got finalized last year as well. And initially they were just to include, you know, centralized exchanges. But right. There was this question during the proposed broker regs of if they should include decentralized exchanges and require them to KYC everyone that uses the platform. And, you know, there was huge industry pushback from this. Basically, everyone's position was that it's going to stifle innovation in the U.S. because if people have to KYC every DeFi user, they're likely going to just location gate people's IPs that are in the U.S. and then the U.S. won't get to transact. So when they came out with the final broker regs, they didn't include the DEXs, but they reserved the right to include them in the future. And basically, I don't remember the exact date. It was a day or two or three before the year ended. So let's, you know, last week in December, they issued an update where they're planning to include DEXs in the definition of a broker. And, you know, it's currently right now getting a lot of industry pushback. I forget the...
It's expensive for them. It's expensive for these guys.
Yeah. And they're going to... Well, they're more concerned with, like, you know, if you go to use Uniswap, if this gets implemented, you're going to have to KYC. And they're going to have to basically take all of your self-identifying information for tax reporting purposes associated with your wallet and then file all that information.
Yeah, well, hang on to that for a second, because we're going to define what KYC is in a moment with all of you that have been listening to that. And we're going to talk about that. But I also want to talk about some advanced topics, which may or may not bore the audience. I don't know, but I'm kind of interested in things like yield farming and maybe even, I don't know, NFTs, if they're going to still be around for a while. But hang on a second. We're going to do a quick break. We'll be right back. And let's take a moment to talk about Interactive Brokers, because Interactive Brokers has key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors like you. IBKR's margin loan rates are just from 4.83% to 5.83%, and they're rated among the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. And you can compare IBKR's low margin borrowing cost to other brokers like E-Trade, Fidelity, Vanguard, who could charge a lot more by hundreds of basis points. Of course, rates are subject to change, and margin is only for experienced investors with high risk tolerance. Now, of course, you could also lose more than your initial investment when you're on margin. So just be aware of that. Listen, the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Go to IBKR.com/compare and check it all out. We're back with Pat Camuso. He's an expert in the area of cryptocurrency, something we don't really talk about very much on the show. We talk about more of the old-fashioned stuff a lot of times, but it's kind of interesting. A lot of listeners I know are interested in this. Let's talk about what we left off on, the area of KYC. Now, I know what that means. Because we have to do that on a regular basis in the old stodgy brokerage field. But I think there's a lot of pushback you mentioned by some of the exchanges that don't want to do this for a variety of different reasons. But KYC is know your client. And it is the mechanism that allows for the exchanges to gather, or requires the exchanges to gather, or the brokerage houses, or your investment advisor, to gather the information on you to make sure that they have all that so that they then can provide reporting to the various governments, right?
Exactly. It stands for know your client. Some people will say know your customer, just depending on, like, you know, who's collecting the information. But ultimately, they're gonna want identifying information from you so they can use it for tax reporting purposes and other compliance purposes.
And the pushback is, if they don't do that, then they're not required to be compliant with the government's information because they don't have it. And therefore, that is an attractive mechanism for some people that are honestly trying to escape the requirements of taxation.
Yeah, so they're, and that's correct. And they're already have required the centralized exchanges to do it. And now they're trying to extend it to decentralized exchanges like Uniswap.
Yeah.
To where, you know, Uniswap isn't really like a centralized company that's controlling the flow of funds like a Coinbase is, but they do have a front end website that is helping to effectuate the transfers.
Isn't the Uniswap all about the ability to transact different cryptocurrencies in a very easy mechanism? In other words, different
ones. In a decentralized manner, uh-huh. Meaning there's no market maker. It's all automated, basically. They're not the same as Coinbase because they're decentralized, but they're still effectuating a transfer, meaning you go to their front end website and you're able to plug your non-custodial wallet in there and trade one asset for another. Right. So they're providing the same service as Coinbase, but they're not a centralized entity. And because they're not centralized and they're not controlling that whole aspect of the company, there's been an argument that they don't need to fall under the definition of a broker. They don't need the KYC and that these transactions will happen in a pseudonymous nature.
My two cents. You want my two cents?
Sure.
My two cents is that ain't going to fly. My two cents is that if you want, you can't have your cake and eat it too here. If you want to be accepted as a, I don't care what you want to call it, whether it's a currency, a stabilization, you know, value proposition, if it's whatever you want to call it, okay? A security, I don't care what you're calling it here. But if you want to be accepted as real and mature and truly something more than some weird speculative asset that's off the grid for purposes of I don't know what, you're going to have to comply with all this.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, you know, it's especially the way it's going to go. It's like the compliance burden is going to get placed on these companies and then they're going to be forced to collect on their customers or they're going to just have so much enforcement placed on them. You know, they just won't be able to stay.
Which the decentralized ones are going to probably end up being problematic. And I would think that the power of the centralized brokerage houses, if you will, the people offering things, they're just going to put, there's too much money involved with them. Comparatively, there's too much lobbying power with them. And again, if you want to have this, if you truly want to have this as a, what do you call this? You know, this is a truly acceptable
mechanism. New asset class.
Yeah, you're going to have, you got to stop playing around with this other stuff that, we're going to get away from, you know, taxes or we could do all this black market stuff. Oh, you know what? We can actually do it outside the boundaries of anybody watching and therefore we can money launder or, you know, we could use it for drugs and buy drugs and, you know, that kind of stuff, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So it's definitely maturing, but within the industry, there's huge pushback regarding
I would think there is. Of course there is.
And a lot of them are saying that the DEXs will just gate people out based off of their location and it'll just stop the U.S. from being able to transact basically on these DEXs. So
you can't have it both ways.
Controversy is, and there's lawsuits right now, but as it stands with these finalized broker regs, DEXs are included. So we're going to really see, you know, the tax information reporting for cryptocurrency really start to change this year and in the coming years.
So let's get to some more advanced topics and we'll reel it in a little bit more to a little easier. Liquidity provisions or yield farming. You familiar with these?
Yes.
How is that? Is there something, first of all, explain and for the audience and then is there any differential in these transactions being taxed or what people need to do?
I would say you want to tread carefully with these transactions. And when in doubt, you should assume that you're triggering taxable events. If you're going to provide liquidity with and, you know, send an asset or two into a protocol and they give you back another asset, that's usually going to be a taxable event because there's two different cryptos that are trading hands.
Again, it's like it's the same thing as short-term capital gains or capital gains. Let me start again. Selling for a capital gain and having wash sales. In other words, it's you can't just simply buy one and sell one and think it's going to be a non-taxable event.
Exactly. And, you know, people try to think that they're non-taxable events. And that's one of the things where they can run into surprise tax issues about, like I was saying before, where, you know, you're going in and out of some protocol and you think you're just providing liquidity with Ethereum or whatever asset that you're using and that it's not taxable, but it usually is going to be taxable. Yeah. So you need to be very careful with that and understanding what the tax implications are, because, you know, you don't want to go and you see the price of Ethereum going up and you want to go get some yield on it and you put it into a protocol where you're exchanging that for a different asset. That's going to be a taxable event.
That's interesting, because are there any ways to actually do this that does not trigger a taxable? So for example, there are stock enhancement programs. There are ways to do things with stock yield enhancement programs. There are ways to actually have your money lent out so that it can be shorted by others, but yet you're not triggering a taxable event.
Yes. Yeah. If you take a crypto and you just put it into a contract, delegate it to a contract, and then that provides you a yield, that's not going to be a taxable event. But if you are going to exchange a crypto or multiple cryptos for another token, like a Uni V2 position, or, you know, going from ETH into WETH, to where you're going to get some yield off of it, but also you're getting a new asset with a new liquidity profile to it, that's really the difference.
Right.
So it's really a question of, like, are you exchanging one asset for another or not? If you're just going to lock up your Ethereum and it's not getting exchanged for anything else, that's not necessarily going to trigger a taxable event. But if you take Ethereum and you exchange it for wrapped Ethereum, that's a totally different story. Mm.
From a global perspective, the taxation of crypto around the world is different, right? We would agree with that? It's different?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Are there crypto tax havens? Some countries are out there, obviously, because they don't have any tax. I mean, we were for a while, right, in theory, right, when we didn't have any tax law. So I mean,
I wouldn't call us a tax haven, because, I mean, people are going to learn. You know, if you ask, for instance, like Frank Algren III about that, he wouldn't call the U.S. a tax haven. That's the first, he's the first guy going to jail over crypto tax evasion, actually. Mm. Mm. He's in the headlines right now because part of his sentence, he's 2 years in jail, and he also has to turn over his private keys to the IRS for all of his crypto.
Yeah, which may yield other tax penalties.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the private keys is actually the control of the assets. Which is really interesting. You know, people say not your keys, not your coin. Right. Well, he's basically turning over his private keys to the IRS. So that's
but for what? They can't for garnishment of back taxes, or for
it's not review? Totally. I've been following this case all year, and this piece of news just came out yesterday. So I've only briefly read an article on it. I haven't delved too deep into it, but basically what they told him is he has to turn over the private keys. And there's a court order that he's not allowed to spend any of the funds without court approval.
But here's a question. How does the IRS know that they're getting all the private keys if they're private? In other words, he has to voluntarily.
They don't know if they're getting all the private keys.
Of course.
But they're already throwing his butt in jail for 2 years because he thought the IRS wouldn't know that he was overstating his Bitcoin cost basis, and they knew that. So it's a very dangerous game, especially if you're already under scrutiny, to only give partial information to any authority, especially the IRS, and especially with crypto, because, you know, all these transactions are taking place on a public immutable ledger. So if this guy only gave them, say, like 95% of his wallets and one's missing, a lot of times they can find what that is by tracking.
By the way, this is a great topic.
You know, this guy's a great example too, because he started everything on Coinbase. He bought everything on Coinbase. Anywhere he's transferred stuff to, there's a trail on it.
Right.
So it's very hard for him to hide that.
But here's the interesting part.
Possibly impossible.
A lot of people thought for a long time they were wrong. They were misinformed. They were, you know, that this whole thing was private. That it was right in the beginning. It was like, oh, you know, I could transact this and nobody will know. It's an asset that's hidden. That, you know, it's asset protected in a way because nobody can get to it and nobody knows where it is. And especially if I take it private into a wallet outside of any of these, you know, centralized at the time, you know. Truth is, that's not the truth. The truth is, it's all out there, and it's all that's the whole point of the blockchain, isn't it? It's the everlasting and able to be removed trail.
Yeah, it's one of the worst asset classes to try to commit tax evasion.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's the first one where every transaction that you've ever done is in a public record in perpetuity. That's immutable, you know. It doesn't matter how many years pass, they're going to be able to go back and see what transactions took place on chain related.
And it's not like they could shred the papers.
Exactly.
You can't shred the blockchain. It's just not. Now, could you take down the entirety of the internet and maybe do some kind of, I don't know, some kind of a weird worm that will kill every computer in the world, and then you're fine? Well, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, good luck with that one. Right. I mean, I'm sure Frank Algren wishes he can do that, but the fact remains is that this guy's been transacting on, you know, a public blockchain. It's not like he's trying to commit tax fraud in cash or in something like real estate where he's maintaining his own books and records even. I mean, you know, there's an objective ledger that's out there that shows every transaction that he's done.
Well, that's just dumb of him then. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been preaching to people for years, you know, this is the one of the dumbest asset classes to try to commit tax evasion in. And it's really just a matter of time. And, you know, people think that the time works to their advantage and like all of the ambiguity around some of the tax considerations around this work to the taxpayer's advantage, but it's actually exactly the opposite. Because, you know, at the end of the day, this stuff is sitting out there for the IRS to pursue at their discretion. And the burden of proof is on you as a taxpayer in any civil case related to anything that you claim on your return. So if something's unclear, if you've done something incorrectly, you know, you could run into issues.
Right. So when we talk about expats or individuals that are holding crypto in multiple jurisdictions, is there any, I mean, obviously this falls under the same rule of, as a U.S. citizen, all of your worldwide income, and that includes capital gains and losses, yes, and things of that nature, are attributable to you.
Right? Definitely.
Nothing different here.
No, nothing different. It's all attributable to you. I will say when you get into expats and people that are living abroad, it does get more complex, you know, related to tax treaties. And sometimes there's certain income that we can exclude up to certain limits to give some tax benefits. But ultimately, yeah, you're taxed on your worldwide income. And if you are living in a different country, the next step you need to take is to understand the tax laws in that country, the timing of when you're making transactions, and what type of tax treaties exist between the U.S. and wherever you're currently residing.
So here we are in the beginning of 2025. And what things can you, in closing, what can we tell people? What can you tell people, whether they're just starting out with crypto or if somebody maybe made a mistake in their crypto in the past, or, you know, what they should be doing to get ready for this tax season to stay compliant with the current tax laws related to their cryptocurrency holdings and transactions?
Yeah, well, the number one thing is to get your accounting up to date, especially, you know, if you've held crypto before the tax year 2025, it's likely that you're not in compliance with this revenue procedure, which means you're exposing yourself to a higher degree of audit risk. And
do you have to submit something to them? Is that the DA? No, that's different.
No. You didn't have to submit something by January 1st, but you had to document certain things in your books and records.
Yeah.
And you have to do the allocations from the universal to the account based either by January 1st or when you first dispose of any of those.
But how do you do that? How do you actually do that? If you're on a centralized, how do you do that? Do you just place the information in under the tax cost basis section, or is it something else?
Well, if you're only on one exchange, there's not really much to allocate, right? Because
right,
it's just all going to be on that one exchange. It's more like people that have been on this universal basis and have multiple exchanges and multiple wallets where they've had an asset, because now you have that cost basis calculation that's maybe spread around to all these accounts, and it needs to get allocated from wherever you've calculated it on this universal basis to each respective account following like a certain procedure.
Right. Interesting.
So that is really the first thing I would say is like, if, you know, if your accounting is not up to date, you're likely not in compliance with this revenue procedure if you have any complexity to your crypto accounting.
Right.
And even if you're just getting started now, I still recommend getting your accounting up to date, because, you know, what I see is like, there's people that come to my firm every week where we're still doing their accounting from 2016, 2017 timeframe. I mean, we just recently did someone from the 2014 timeframe, which is a more rare, but, you know, 16 and 17, we're going back to that on a weekly basis right now.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just, there's all sorts of issues that can arise when you have to go that far back and do these calculations. So, you know, someone like you that's just maybe on Coinbase is definitely safer, but I would even still say, like, you know, do a cost basis calculation, get it all up to date, just so you know that you have that correct and you don't have to worry about doing those calculations, or, you know, those calculations for tax purposes related to future dispositions, or if you get a tax notice in the mail,
good stuff,
which we're seeing a lot of right now. So I would say, you know, get yourself accounting up to date and get in compliance with this revenue procedure in order to prepare for, you know, the tax reporting that's coming out, and to protect yourself from the ramp up in tax enforcement that we're going to be seeing this year. And if you take those steps, then you can start to be in a better position to stay on top of your portfolio going forward and optimize it from a tax perspective, from a tax planning perspective.
Smart. Patrick Camuso from Camuso CPA. We'll have all the information, of course, on the show notes for episode number 903 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. That's going to wrap it. Just package it. Just nice, tidy bow on top of this episode. Thanks for joining me. Hopefully you gleaned a good amount of information from that. Next week, we got Ryan Zabrowski coming up, author of a great book and a great financial analyst. We have Howard Lindzen, Carson Block. We have a list of people coming up over the next month. That's just amazing. The A-list. Danielle DiMartino Booth is going to be with us as well. I mean, there is a pretty good list here. Wes Gray from Alpha Architect is going to be here in the next few weeks. Carly Garner. Boy, let me tell you something. Do not touch that dial. Make sure to stay subscribed and tell your friends about the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. Discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.